Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
Listening to WBAI Radio in New York City. I'm Catherine Davis in studio with
Paulette Spencer.
And we're here sharing this evening with you, a special day for many, perhaps most. And so we're going to see how it turns. It'll be interesting. Please do stay tuned.
I'm
I'm with the NSA. My name is, well, not important. What is important is the holiday spirit, that time of year when we all come together in the spirit of peace, love, and national security. Here at the NSA, nobody is more concerned with your privacy than we are, and we recently discovered it's being violated by not us. Our surveillance network has picked up an extremely dangerous foreign spy. He seems able to slip in and out of any home with a chimney, and he moves so fast that the only pictures we've gotten of him have been blurry. This man, we've codenamed Santana, seems to live completely off the grid. We had to tap every single cell phone in the country just to make sure none of them were his. Turns out they're not, but we'll keep trying. Our search is complicated by the fact that he seems to have body doubles everywhere. He must be commanding these imposters to be unruly because they can often be found breaking the law and getting drunk in public. He was able to penetrate our most secret facilities and leave flammable materials there. We can only assume the sock was to be a crude fuse for the fires he wanted to start. We're just lucky he got scared away before he could ignite them. This hits particularly close to home for me because he put extra lumps of this flammable material in my own personal sock. Most importantly, though, he's stolen data from our computers. We've been keeping a list of who's been naughty, who's been nice, and who's been saying the word nachos. That one's just because we can. But he's stolen this list from our facility and wiped all of the data behind it. That's millions of gigabytes. It's critical that we get it back. So please, if you see a man matching this description, just open up your phone and say codename Santana or type it into a web browser. That's all you have to do. Believe me, we'll see it. With your help, we can finally put this dangerous man where he truly belongs.
Silver ships, lights, and so strange.
Welcome back. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM on your dial, and WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis in studio with Paulette Spencer, and we played a number of songs for you. And let's see, we started with Michelle Indiacello, Earth, and then you heard The Little Drummer Boy by The Temptations. And then we heard The 13 Days of Solstice, a Pagan Yule Carols by Corrine Skye. We heard A Christmas Warning from the NSA. And Shanghai Lily Dublin, Rocket Christmas. The Times They Are a-Changin', Mary Clapton. And that's Dylan's gospel music, is one of his songs. And we ended with Jewel, I Have Seen. So that was a nice Christmas mix, don't you think? Thank you, Paulette.
You're most welcome.
Paulette has contributed the majority of that music to the program this evening, and I thought that was a fun mix, a little bit of reverence and a little bit of irreverence all in one package. So it was nice. It's interesting. We are now officially in the day designated as a celebration of the birth of Christ, as Jesus Christ is known. But some people think of it or say Jesus the Christ, because Christ really means anointed one. It wasn't his true name. The name that he is more traditionally known and is Yeshua ben Joseph, which basically means Yeshua the son of Joseph. And as it turns out, I found out today that that Yeshua itself, I think, has an interesting meaning. I'm going to see if I can find that here. Yeah, Yeshua is an ancient mystical name that signifies bringing the formless into form. That's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Very interesting.
And primarily it's interesting because I think of the Christ more as an energy, more as a level of consciousness, because in the teachings of Yeshua ben Joseph, primarily he's teaching people to follow the way that he's showing through his example. And he never really claimed to be the only one. And he was setting out an example for all of us to follow to get to that level of consciousness that he had, which is signified by the that Christ consciousness, to be of the anointed, to have that higher vibrational consciousness, which is, I think, what the whole idea is. I mean, that's a Christian understanding of or explanation of, I guess, the evolution of mankind, because I'm sure when Yeshua was walking the earth with his teachings, his intention was not to be, you know, some special guy. I think his intention was to change the lives of everyone. For those of us who think he actually lived, I think he did. I think that such a person did exist and live, but I believe it is more of an energy that manifested through many of whom we consider to be the prophets of our world. It could have, you know, the same energy you in the East would be Buddha, you know, the same energy in Islamic faith, I guess, would be Muhammad. So I think it's an energy that comes through, that has come through the ages at various times. And you'll find it also in indigenous cultures. In ancient America, they had a Christ figure. I don't remember his name, but there was also an indigenous person who traveled around the Americas unifying people and is responsible for a lot of the best philosophies of indigenous cultures, you know, that our constitution ripped off from them. You know, it was really interesting. Do I sound jaded?
No.
Just a little bit?
I don't think so.
Anyway, so I think it's interesting because it's an interesting time. It's an interesting season of holidays with Kwanzaa and Christmas and Hanukkah. And it's all about giving, which is a really wonderful concept. I think giving a gift of love to someone that you care about is a wonderful thing. I just think that we often get into trouble with the commercial, I spoke of this last week, the trap of buying and spending. Many people go into a lot of debt around Christmas time. I used to. I certainly used to. I don't anymore. It might have something to do with the fact that I don't have a credit card, but still. You know, I'm glad I'm not really into the spending of money. So this year I made all of my gifts. I did make gifts.
Wow.
I didn't buy gifts. I made them all. So I think that's pretty, you know, a good way to do it. You know, you put love, time, and attention into something, and that makes it fun and special. And, you know, the creative process is a wonderful thing. It's very uplifting, I feel.
I agree with you completely.
Yeah. So are you religious, Paulette?
I wouldn't say I'm religious, but I definitely am spiritual.
Yeah.
I definitely feel a sense of connectedness with people and a sense of not intentionally doing harm.
Yeah. I think most people can agree with that. Yeah, I think most. I was gonna qualify that, but I believe that most people can believe that. Because you don't have to believe in a god or a religion or anything to have a humanist view of the world and to have a compassion and be a loving person. It doesn't require religion or even spirituality, really. It just requires, I guess, a certain level of connection to your humanity and understanding that we're all really interconnected, really. And, you know, you can't hurt people on the other side of the world without hurting yourself. And that's what we witness. You know, it's like this endless back and forth of harm that tends to escalate. So I think many of us would love for these teachings to come to a blossoming state in the world, because it's what we're all working towards, all of the activists and people doing protests and people doing good work in the world, trying to help the homeless and the sick. There's a lot of good that we don't hear too much about on the news.
I agree. I mean, there are a lot of people in the world that take it upon themselves to stand up on behalf of other people.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot to celebrate in whether one has a belief system that is attached to a holiday or attached to a religion, no matter what that religion might be. I think it's the spirit of this, of the meaning, that is worthwhile and worth really embodying, I think, truthfully. And it's nice when you're, you know, it's a little bit disconcerting to see people burdened by their packages and stressed out over making sure they have everybody on their list. And I see people, you know, on the phones, I'm getting ready for Christmas, you know, on people on the phone with bicycles, I mean, on the trains with bicycles and stuff for their kids. It really does look very stressful. From the outside looking in, it looks very, very stressful. So, yeah, but, you know, it's a good thing, I think, in many ways, to be able to have that experience of family gathering and celebration. It's pretty cool.
I think that what happens is, of course, the sort of commercialization of our wish to bond with each other.
Yeah.
So as you were saying, you know, creating your own gift and just sharing that part of yourself with someone else, mm-hmm. that's the bond. But then when you add the commercial interests, they say, oh, you want to bond? Well, you know, well, you can bond if you give us your money,
yeah.
You know, and it becomes a big industry. But the act of giving in and of itself, I think, is a very beautiful thing.
It is. And it's something that we can do all the time.
Absolutely.
We can do all the time. And it's interesting. I was having a conversation a week or so ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, with a woman who is very much into spirituality as I am, but she's also a whistleblower. And, you know, I'll be bringing her to the air in a couple of weeks. And she talks about... Donna Novick is her name, and she talks about an experience she had in a hospital where she blew the whistle on the hospital because they refused to treat a homeless man, and he left the hospital and died outside the hospital. And so she's been going through this harassment of the from the system because she was a whistleblower. And so it's a very poignant story, but she has taken it to a different level of not returning the anger and the suffering that's been visited upon her, but has reached a place of understanding that you could only really forgive people and try to bring more love into the world, even though she's gone through this terrible experience. And I think that this is a lesson, for me, it was a lesson that we could all learn from, that conflict and anger and fear can be very contagious. And when you're expanding upon those emotions, they create more of the same. And so when we can embody the spirit of what Christmas represents, or in our lives, and when we can embody the teachings of Yeshua, then it gives us an opportunity, or Buddha, and Muhammad. If you read the Quran, it's really a very peaceful book. You know, even though there's a lot of militancy in all of the religions, at the core of them is a very peaceful and loving teaching. And when we follow those teachings, or the humanist teachings, despite the horrific things that might happen, it helps us to magnify that good and bring about more of that good. And so I think it's worthwhile to make that effort.
I agree with you, and I think, I guess if I, one of the things that I do sort of ascribe to is the sense of karma.
Mm.
And I do think that what you put out in the world, you know, eventually will find its way back to you.
I agree. And I think that's very true. It's very, very true. So anger will breed more anger. Violence will breed more violence. Fear will breed more fear. And it can be very tragic, because you may be coming from the desire to change things and the desire for good, but because you're bringing to it that energy of violence, you're actually contributing to more violence. It's kind of tragic.
And the opposite is also true. You know, those small acts of kindness, hopefully sometimes will come back to you when you least expect it and need it the most.
I agree. I think that they do. They don't always come when you need it the most.
That's true.
But they do come back.
Point taken.
But the truth of it is, even though it may not come back to you when you might expect it, it usually comes when you least expect it, and it's a grateful surprise and welcome surprise. But beyond the karma of return to you, it's your creating in the world change in another kind of way. So in that sense, as we contribute to an environment of positive change that allows us to live in a world that will be much more beneficial to us.
I agree. And I think that even beyond our physical presence in the world, that once you put something out there, it becomes your legacy.
Yeah.
So when you the people whose lives you've touched while you're here in the physical world, once you leave this realm, you still touch their lives.
And it keeps going.
Absolutely.
It keeps going. That you're right about that. It's a beautiful thing. And that's why sometimes we have to really look at how we interact and engage with people. Because when life is so frustrating sometimes and difficult, if we get a little bit too trapped in that mindset, we begin to reflect that in our relationship to people with impatience, with sharp tone or sharp words. And we can, without intention, create harm, hurt people with that. So it's really good to have an awareness and a consciousness of what our interaction is creating in the world. And to me, that's what a day such as this is good for. It's good to reflect on that. And I think far too often people end up in situations that are so stressful on a holiday that they can't really enjoy it, that they can't really sit back and appreciate the fact that they actually have a family to spend time with, or that they're alive. I had a really nice walk today. I have been doing some work at I work with a a minister, a reverend, who invited me to do Qigong. Actually, when I started doing Qigong at the Riverside Church, she invited me there. And then she moved to Good Shepherd Faith Church in Manhattan. She invited me there, and now she's at a church in Brooklyn. But, you know, I've been, so I've been helping her. She's been helping me. And what's really interesting is that, you know, we just, you know, had a nice Christmas meal together, and it was rainy and misty, and I decided to walk home. And it was like the most beautiful experience. You would think that it was cold and chilly and wet, but somehow it just became very beautiful and mystical. And as I was just taking my time and breathing, the raindrops became on the trees like little diamonds on the trees. Mm. And it was just a very beautiful experience. And I was like really glad that I had done it, because I didn't expect it. You know, I just thought I was going to walk home in the cold. And it turned out into this really beautiful Christmassy experience on Christmas Eve with the rain drops in the trees. So it was interesting. And so being alive can be a beautiful experience if we just relax with it and see what presents to us. So it's nice. Living can be wonderful if we can take a step back from the fear, the stress, the trepidation, and the frustration and anger about what's going on around us. Because there is a lot going on around us that that can create a really bad experience, a bad feeling about the world, about humanity, about each other. So we have to take back our humanity from the wickedness that's going on in the world.
I agree. And sometimes that's kind of, I would think it's kind of difficult to do, especially I'm thinking of people who don't have a roof over their head, you know, or that, you know, combined with whatever possible chronic illnesses that they have.
This is true, and this is where the acts of kindness can really come in.
Absolutely.
Come into the picture. It's really hard, because when you see it, it hurts. You know, and part of the temptation is to look away or walk away or pretend it's not there. But sometimes you just have to allow it to hurt and to be aware so that you can connect with that person. I was on the train, was it last week or maybe a week ago, actually going home from this show, and a woman came into the train, and someone had given her some food, and she was eating some food, but you could see she wasn't dressed warmly. And she just sort of walked into the train and she seemed very disoriented. And so I stopped and asked her, I said, "Are you okay? What's going on?" And somehow, just interacting with her and speaking with her grounded her a little bit and helped her. And so she just sat down and started enjoying her food and felt like it was okay for her to be where she was. And sometimes homeless people feel, well, I don't know what they feel, but I have expressed to me a sense of not having the right to even take space in the world. And it's a terrible thing for someone to say something like that to you. "Oh, I'm sorry for taking up space." And it's like a person like that needs to be loved, needs to be hugged, needs to be acknowledged. And I don't think that all homeless people are at that state of desperation, but some people are. Some people really are. And people who have homes can be just as lonely. You know, there may be elderly people in the building you live. Maybe stop and say Merry Christmas. There may be, or take a piece of pie to someone. You know, there's a lot we can do that is just human, to acknowledge each other and to help each other. We can't take care of everyone, but we can smile and acknowledge that they exist. And if you have food or money, you can offer a little bit of something to someone. So there's a lot we can do.
Sure. Yeah. There's a lot we can do. And just going back to what we were speaking about earlier with bonding, mm-hmm. you know, that food, that little bit of money, that acknowledgement, that's a bond.
Yeah, it is. It really is. I mean, I know I've never experienced that, and I'm grateful for that. But I do come from I grew up in a family that didn't have resources. My mother was on SSI, and there was never really enough. And so I have a sense of what that feels like to, you know, at the end of the month, not have food. You know, that kind of situation it's not always, you know, it's a difficult thing, and all we can do is be compassionate with people to the best of our ability.
I agree.
And I advocate for that on a yearly basis. Well, we don't have a lot of time today. We're only going for an hour because Hour of the Wolf has a 2-hour, 3-hour special, I'm not sure which. So he'll be in a little bit later, and I want to share a little bit more music with you. So let's see if I can click on a little bit of music, and we can get into the spirit of Christmas. Interrupting for an important announcement.
So I wanted to let everyone know that we've decided on the date of the public memorial tribute to Robert Knight. It will be Saturday, the 28th of March at the Riverside Church Theater, which is at 120th Street and Claremont Avenue in Manhattan. I'm right now in the process of settling what time it will start, most likely early evening, about 6:30 or 7 p.m., and you're all welcome to attend. There will be an RSVP so that I just have a sense of how many persons plan to come, but everyone is welcome.
Are they able to connect with you now? Do you have a website or email you want to use?
You can send me an email at thenightreport@gmail.com.
Excellent.
until it can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy.
I still believe all you need is love, you know, but I don't believe that just saying it is going to do it, you know. I mean, yeah. I still believe in the fact that love is what we all need.
And it was for love. It was for love and bloody peace again, you know. It was a fabulous time.
Keep on a-talkin', marching up to freedom land.
And we just wanted to give you another reminder of the memorial coming up.
Yes, the memorial tribute to Robert Knight will be held on Saturday, March 28th. We should be starting around 6:37 p.m., and it will be held at the Riverside Church Theater at 120th Street and Claremont Avenue in Manhattan.
And the email?
The email for RSVP is thenightreport@gmail.com.
Thank you, and stay tuned for a special broadcast of Hour of the Wolf.
More. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Thanks to Pauline and Catherine, we are able to start a little bit early, so the Council of the Lord will introduce to me. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Let me be blunt about this. The cliffhanger that ended The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, that wasn't necessary. That entire chapter is wrapped up in the first 20 minutes, maybe not even that, the first 15 minutes of The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, never to be visited again. By all rights, the entire sequence should have played out in the previous film and be done with it. And you can understand why the producers didn't do that. The confrontation with the dragon Smaug, voiced here by Benedict Cumberbatch, is kind of the money shot of The Hobbit. Once he's out of the picture, does anybody really care about a turf war over a decrepit, albeit gold-glazed subterranean kingdom, even if the conflict involves screen-filling, computer-generated ranks of humans, elves, dwarfs, orcs, etc., etc.? Not all that much. Seems the producers knew that, and apparently fearing that once Smaug was out of the running, it was going to be hard luring audiences back for the final installment of their trilogy, they decided to cheat. And that speaks to how much of a disaster it's been breaking this simple tale into three epic, unwieldy motion pictures. Tell it as one grand, concise adventure, and you don't have to play such tricks. Divide it up, and you have to do stuff like find tortured reasons to keep your title character relevant, which is what happens in this particular installment. This isn't Bilbo's story. Not often I say this, but it turns out Rankin Bass had it right all along. But as a final installment, Battle of the Five Armies goes down easy enough. At 2 hours and 24 minutes, the bloat is still detectable, but it isn't really painful, just kind of pointless. But that led to something of a personal revelation for me. Going in, I kind of felt like my main motivation for dragging myself to this third chapter was so I could say I was among that smallish sampling of humanity that had seen the only three films that would ever be exhibited in the dreadful high frame rate projection process. It isn't any better here, by the way. But as the film went on, I realized I was there for another reason. I was looking for signs that the better Peter Jackson, the visually inventive director who made The Lord of the Rings such a feast, still existed. And indeed, glimmers show up throughout five armies. In a sequence where delusional Thorin Oakenshield envisions himself drowning in a sea of gold, in a moment when a vanquished orc chieftain is glimpsed floating beneath the surface of a frozen stream, a beautiful, eerie vision that invokes Jackson's affection for German expressionism. That quest for those moments, as much as anything, kept me engaged in The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, if only to dream that after this whole misbegotten exercise, Jackson finally acquires some impulse control and starts telling tales that leave us begging for more rather than wishing for less. But let me suggest this. If what you're looking for at the cinema is a fantastic adventure suffused with magic, leave The Battle of the Five Armies for a while. It'll be around for a few more weeks at least. And go to see Song of the Sea, which also opened in New York City this past weekend. This is the second animated film from Irish director Tom Moore, following his wonderful Oscar-nominated The Secret of Kells, and it is just as bracingly imaginative, exciting, and moving. Once again pulling from Irish legend, Moore this time tells a contemporary tale of a young boy who discovers his sister is part Selkie, a sea-bound mystical creature, and has to find a way to get her back to the ocean to save her life. There are strange supernatural creatures, good and ill, encountered along the way, and a legend of a grieving giant turned to stone that figures into it. All of it told with a deceptively simple two-dimensional palette that leads to a wealth of stunningly elaborate visuals. Song of the Sea is a lithe, beautiful, entertaining adventure, truly magical and fun. Another great animated film to close out the year. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website. If you want to check out what you've missed, please go over to mightymoviepodcast.com.
And good morning. Talking with Paulette and Kathy as they go out. Hello. Get over here. Doors here are crazy, you know?
I forgot my air checks.
Yeah. You know what happened to me once?
Did you make it? Are you making one?
I'm not. I don't need one, thank you. No, what happened to me once is I usually, as you know, have my USB drive in the USB slot, and my normal USB drive is on my keys. I got all the way home, all the way to the southern tip of Brooklyn, only to find my keys were here. Had to come back. Double trip. Good night. So, as I was saying, first of all, thank you, Dan, for that review. It's a very sad thing to say that Rankin-Bass got it right. It really is. Not that the animation was so terrible or anything, but the Glenn Yarbrough music, the whole thing with that Hobbit. I liked Orson Bean's voice, but they got the story right. And for that matter, they got the story right on Ralph Bakshi's first half of The Lord of the Rings with a screenplay by none other than Peter S. Beagle, somebody who knows his Tolkien. But what of that? Okay. This is going to be, of course, a proper All Tolkien show. Tell me that I copied the wrong files. Indeed, I copied the wrong files. But you know what? I copied them twice. Pardon me while I again unprofessionally get off mic. And you know what? We're going to play just a little bit of music. And and be back while I swap USB drives. So stay tuned. And even that didn't work. It's like locking the keys in the car. Okay, let's see. Did I now bring... yes. Okay, we're good. We're good. I'm silly, but I'm stupid, but we're good. Okay. We'll deal with Ring Out Solstice bells later. So what was I saying? Yes, two movies open this holiday season. One of them is Annie, and one of the reviews said, "Come back, John Huston, all is forgiven." And Dan, in essence, said, "Come back, Rankin Bass, all is forgiven." These are sad things to say, because those were two poor movies. But when it comes to The Lord of the Rings, a movie that, for the most part, Peter Jackson got right, there is a major story that he left out. It takes place in the movie. It runs about 4 minutes. What you're about to hear runs about 90 minutes. It is the Council of Elrond. It is book two, chapter... book two, chapter two of The Lord of the Rings. It is after Frodo has worked his way through all kinds of dangers and ring wraiths on horses and things like that, that he finds his way to Rivendell to discover that this is where Bilbo, his uncle, has gone after his 111th birthday. And at this point, all the characters have gathered together to tell the story of why Frodo is holding this funny ring that Bilbo got during The Hobbit. That story of how Bilbo got it is not told here. What is told is how each of the characters arrived in Rivendell. And then, now that the ring is there and they've determined what the ring is, what shall they do with it? You do not have to know Tolkien at all to appreciate the storytelling here. This is a self-contained part of The Lord of the Rings. It was chosen by Baird Searles, who, when I started at WBAI in 1967, was our drama and literature director. It was, I brought in Baird to do this. He called Tolkien and got the permission to do this. I actually got on the phone with Tolkien to get the pronunciation of G-A-N-D-A-L-F. You can say Gandalf. Professor Tolkien said Gandalf. And that is how you shall hear it here. We were fastidious with the pronunciations, not how Tolkien scholars have it, but how Tolkien had it. Let's deal with that. And I know, by the way, I'm saying Tolkien, and so many people say Tolkien. And this is how all the people I know who actually had known the professor say it was Tolkien. It's not Tolkien, it's not Tolkien, it's sort of Tolkien. Dan Persons, an email, asked, and he spelled it T-O-L-K-Y-E-N. I would say that's about right, Tolkien. At any rate. We had a recording engineer at WBAI in 1972 when this was recorded, David Marks, who I so surprisingly and so happily ran into at the Book Expo of America this past year and hope to again this coming year. It's usually in April, as I recall. And Dave, at that point, had read Lord of the Rings maybe 5 times and was as much of an expert on Tolkien as anybody, with the possible exception of Baird Searles. But this thing needed to be recorded. He and I did the editing. The person who really watched over the production of this thing and was in charge was Margot Adler, who is the creator of Hour of the Wolf and who died this past July. By the way, it has taken me this long to write a piece, written words on who Margot was to me and to the world. And it was finally published on the 20th by a website, Jewish Women of America. And I believe they are at jwa.org. You can go there directly and read the piece that I wrote. And there are some nice photographs there, too, some of which have never been seen by the public before. I know, because they're my pictures, and I've never put them out before. They were private, at least one of them. If you don't get to see it, send me an email, jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com, and I will send you a copy or guide you to it. And also, if you go to my Facebook page or to the Hour of the Wolf Facebook page, you will find a link to it there. In fact, even on the WBAI Radio Facebook page. That's the users, fans, listeners page, as opposed to the official WBAI page on Facebook. Okay, getting back to Tolkien. This is, as I said, in the movie, this lasts maybe 4 minutes. Here, it's going to last a little over 90. And the events are covered in the movie, but what Jackson did was he took the events of how everybody gets to the council, where in the book it's all told in flashback. Oh, here's my story, here's who this person is, and here's how I got here. Why are you late, Gandalf? And all that, as you're about to hear. In the movie, we go sequentially. We actually see these things, most of these things happen in chronological order. There are actually a number of things, like traveling down from Gondor and stuff like that, which are omitted. But there's only so much you can do in a 13-hour movie, right? Then why did they add all that other stuff? Anyway, this is one of the productions that I have done through the years, of which I am proudest. And when possible, I like to play it as close to the December holidays, not necessarily Christmas, but solstice, as possible, so that you can... because it has a feeling of joy. Apparently, the people that have been putting out the Lord of the Rings movies agree with that. It used to be that people didn't put out movies near the Christmas season. Now, it's swung the other way. It's something that people do. So, with no further ado, for the next hour, and it's under 90 minutes by a few seconds, for the next hour, 29 minutes and 34 seconds, the amazing Baird Searles, man, I could go on for hours about him and what he did for WBAI, what he did for World Radio, first gay programming ever, anywhere. And people will say, oh, such and such did a show. Turns out, no, that show was produced by Baird. So even if he wasn't on it, it was still Baird doing it. And at a time when people weren't doing radio drama, Baird was producing it. And when I came here in 1967, Baird had Samuel R. Delaney doing The Star Pit, a radio drama that we like to play every so often. It may be a little dated, but it's still brilliant. And the other people hanging out at the station because of Baird included Theodore Sturgeon, Tom Dish, Joanna Russ, who worked for him on radio dramas as, quote, the script girl. I didn't name it. She did. And he left here in 1970. This is 2 years later. And it took a little coaxing to get him back. He was not happy when he left. He felt that the station at the time had a good deal of homophobia. Well, yes, it did, in my opinion. In some quarters, it still does. It also has quarters that embrace the other in so many ways, which is a lot of what fantasy and science fiction are about. It's about the other and coming to terms with it. Even The Lord of the Rings. So, that being said, here is The Council of Elrond by J.R.R. Tolkien. If you, again, if you have the book, The Fellowship of the Ring or The Lord of the Rings, this is Book 2, Chapter 2. Enjoy.
The Council of Elrond. Next day, Frodo woke early, feeling refreshed and well. He walked along the terraces above the loud flowing Bruinen and watched the pale, cool sun rise above the far mountains and shine down, slanting through the thin silver mist. The dew upon the yellow leaves was glimmering, and the woven nets of gossamer twinkled on every bush. Sam walked beside him, saying nothing but sniffing the air and looking every now and again with wonder in his eyes at the great heights in the east. The snow was white upon their peaks. On a seat cut in the stone beside a turn in the path, they came upon Gandalf and Bilbo, deep in talk. "Hello, good morning," said Bilbo. "Feeling ready for the Great Council?" "I feel ready for anything," answered Frodo. "But most of all, I should like to go walking today and explore the valley. I should like to get into those pine woods up there." He pointed away far up the side of Rivendell to the north. "You may have a chance later," said Gandalf, "but we cannot make any plans yet. There is much to hear and decide today." Suddenly, as they were talking, a clear, single bell rang out. "That is the warning bell for the Council of Elrond," cried Gandalf. "Come along now. Both you and Bilbo are wanted." Frodo and Bilbo followed the wizard quickly along the winding path back to the house. Behind them, uninvited and for the moment forgotten, trotted Sam. Gandalf led them to the porch where Frodo had found his friends the evening before. The light of the clear autumn morning was now glowing in the valley. The noise of bubbling waters came up from the foaming riverbed. Birds were singing, and a wholesome peace lay on the land. To Frodo, his dangerous flight and the rumors of the darkness growing the world outside already seemed only the memories of a troubled dream. But the faces that were turned to meet them as they entered were grave. Elrond was there, and several others were seated in silence about him. Frodo saw Glorfindel and Glóin, and in a corner, alone, Strider was sitting, clad in his old, travel-worn clothes again. Elrond drew Frodo to a seat by his side and presented him to the company, saying, "Here, my friends, is the hobbit, Frodo, son of Drogo. Few have ever come hither through greater peril or on an errand more urgent." He then pointed out and named those whom Frodo had not met before. There was a younger dwarf at Glóin's side, his son Gimli. Beside Glorfindel, there were several other counselors of Elrond's household, of whom Aristor was the chief, and with him was Galdor, an elf from the Grey Havens, who had come on an errand from Círdan the shipwright. There was also a strange elf clad in green and brown, Legolas, a messenger from his father, Thranduil, the king of the elves of northern Mirkwood. And seated a little apart was a tall man with a fair and noble face, dark-haired and gray-eyed, proud and stern of glance. He was cloaked and booted as if for a journey on horseback, and indeed, though his garments were rich and his cloak was lined with fur, they were stained with long travel. He had a collar of silver in which a single white stone was set. His locks were shorn about his shoulders. On a baldric he wore a great horn tipped with silver that was now laid upon his knees. He gazed at Frodo and Bilbo with sudden wonder. "Here," said Elrond, turning to Gandalf, "is Boromir, a man from the south. He arrived in the gray morning and seeks for counsel. I have bidden him to be present, for here his questions will be answered." Not all that was spoken and debated in the council need now be told. Much was said of events in the world outside, especially in the south, and in the wide lands east of the mountains. Of these things Frodo had already heard many rumors, but the tale of Glóin was new to him, and when the dwarves spoke he listened attentively. It appeared that amid the splendor of their works of hand the hearts of the dwarves of the Lonely Mountain were troubled. "It is now many years ago," said Glóin, "that a shadow of disquiet fell upon our people. Whence it came we did not at first perceive. Words began to be whispered in secret. It was said that we were hemmed in a narrow place, and that greater wealth and splendor could be found in a wider world. Some spoke of Moria, the mighty works of our fathers that are called in our own tongue Khazad-dûm, and they declared that now at last we had the power and numbers to return." Glóin sighed. "Moria, Moria, wonder of the northern world. Too deep we delved there and woke the nameless fear. Long have its vast mansions lain empty since the children of Durin fled. But now we spoke of it again with longing and yet with dread, for no dwarf has dared to pass the doors of Khazad-dûm for many lives of kings, save Thror only, and he perished. At last, however, Balin listened to their whispers and resolved to go. And though Dain did not give leave willingly, he took with him Ori and Owen and many of our folk, and they went away south. That was nigh on 30 years ago. For a while we had news, and it seemed good. Messages reported that Moria had been entered and a great work begun there. Then there was silence, and no word has ever come from Moria since. Then about a year ago, a messenger came to Dain, but not from Moria, from Mordor. A horseman in the night who called Dain to his gate. The Lord Sauron the Great, so he said, wished for our friendship. Rings he would give for it, such as he gave of old. And he asked urgently concerning hobbits, of what kind they were and where they dwelt. For Sauron knows, said he, that one of these was known to you on a time. At this we were greatly troubled, and we gave no answer. And then his fell voice was lowered, and he would have sweetened it if he could. As a small token only of your friendship, Sauron asked this, he said, that you should find this thief. Such was his word. And get from him, willing or no, a little ring, the least of rings that once he stole. It is but a trifle that Sauron fancies, and an earnest of your good will. Find it, and 3 rings that the dwarf sires possessed of old shall be returned to you, and the realm of Moria shall be yours forever. Find only news of the thief, whether he still lives and where, and you shall have great reward and lasting friendship from the Lord. Refuse, and things will not seem so well. Do you refuse? At that his breath came like the hiss of snakes, and all who stood by shuddered. But Dain said, I say neither yea nor nay. I must consider this message and what it means under its fair cloak. Consider well, but not too long, said he. The time of my thoughts is my own to spend, answered Dain. For the present, said he, and rode into darkness. Heavy have the hearts of our chieftains been since that night. We needed not the fell voice of the messenger to warn us that his words held both menace and deceit, for we knew already that the power that has re-entered Mordor has not changed, and ever it betrayed us of old. Twice the messenger has returned and has gone unanswered. The third and last time, so he says, is soon to come, before the ending of the year. And so I've been sent at last by Dan to warn Bilbo that he is sought by the enemy and to learn, if may be, why he desires this ring, this least of rings. Also, we crave the advice of Elrond, for the shadow grows and draws nearer. We discover that messengers have come also to King Brand in Dale, and that he is afraid. We fear that he may yield. Already war is gathering on his eastern borders. If we make no answer, the enemy may move men of his rule to assail King Brand and Dan also. You have done well to come, said Elrond. You will hear today all that you need in order to understand the purpose of the enemy. There is naught that you can do other than to resist, with hope or without it. But you do not stand alone. You will learn that your trouble is but part of the trouble of all the Western world. The ring. What shall we do with the ring, the least of rings, that trifle that Sauron fancies? That is the doom that we must deem. That is the purpose for which you are called hither. Called, I say, though I have not called you to me, strangers from distant lands. You have come and are here met in this very nick of time, by chance, as it may seem. Yet it is not so. Believe rather that it is so ordered that we, who sit here, and none others, must now find counsel for the peril of the world. Now, therefore, things shall be openly spoken that have been hidden from all but a few until this day. And first, so that all may understand what is the peril, the tale of the ring shall be told from the beginning even to this present, and I will begin that tale, though others shall end it. Then all listened while Elrond in his clear voice spoke of Sauron and the Rings of Power and their forging in the second age of the world long ago. A part of his tale was known to some there, but the full tale to none, and many eyes were turned to Elrond in fear and wonder as he told of the elven smiths of Eregion and their friendship with Moria and their eagerness for knowledge by which Sauron ensnared them. For in that time he was not yet evil to behold, and they received his aid and grew mighty in craft, whereas he learned all their secrets and betrayed them and forged secretly in the Mountain of Fire the one ring to be their master. But Celebrimbor was aware of him and hid the three which he had made, and there was war, and the land was laid waste, and the gate of Moria was shut. Then through all the years that followed he traced the ring, but since that history is elsewhere recounted, even as Elrond himself set it down in his books of lore, it is not here recalled, for it is a long tale full of deeds great and terrible. And briefly, though Elrond spoke, the sun rode up the sky, and the morning was passing ere he ceased. Of Numenor he spoke, its glory and its fall, and the return of the kings of men to Middle-earth out of the deeps of the sea, borne upon the wings of storm. Then Elendil the Tall and his mighty sons, Isildur and Anarion, became great lords. In the north realm they made in Arnor, and the south realm in Gondor above the mouths of Anduin. But Sauron of Mordor assailed them, and they made the last alliance of elves and men, and the hosts of Gil-galad and Elendil were mustered in Arnor. Thereupon Elrond paused a while and sighed. I remember well the splendor of their banners, he said. It recalled to me the glory of the elder days and the hosts of Beleriand. So many great princes and captains were assembled, and yet not so many nor so fair as when Thangorodrim was broken and the elves deemed that evil was ended forever, and it was not so. You remember, said Frodo, speaking his thought aloud in his astonishment. But I thought he stammered as Elrond turned towards him. I thought that the fall of Gil-galad was a long age ago. So it was indeed, answered Elrond gravely. But my memory reaches back even to the elder days. Yarendil was my sire, who was born in Gondolin before its fall. And my mother was Elwing, daughter of Dior, son of Luthien of Doriath. I have seen three ages in the west of the world, and many defeats, and many fruitless victories. I was the herald of Gil-galad, and marched with his host. I was at the Battle of Dagalad before the Black Gate of Mordor, where we had the mastery. For the spear of Gil-galad and the sword of Elendil, Aglaos and Narsil, none could withstand. I beheld the last combat on the slopes of Ardruin, where Gilgalad died, and Elendil fell, and Narsil broke beneath him. But Sauron himself was overthrown, and Isildur cut the ring from his hand with the hilt shard of his father's sword and took it for his own. At this, the stranger, Boromir, broke in. "So that is what became of the ring," he cried. "If ever such a tale was told in the south, it has been long forgotten. I have heard of the great ring of him that we do not name, but we believe that it perished from the world in the ruin of his first realm. Isildur took it. That is tidings indeed." "Alas, yes," said Elrond. "Isildur took it as should not have been. It should have been cast then into Orodruin's fire, nigh at hand where it was made. But few marked what Isildur did. He alone stood by his father in that last mortal contest, and by Gilgalad only Círdan stood, and I. But Isildur would not listen to our counsel. 'This I will have as weregild for my father and my brother,' he said, 'and therefore, whether we would or no, he took it to treasure it. But soon he was betrayed by it to his death, and so it is named in the north Isildur's Bane. Yet death maybe was better than what else might have befallen him.'" "Only to the north did these tidings come, and only to a few. Small wonder it is that you have not heard them, Boromir. From the ruin of the gladdened fields where Isildur perished, three men only came ever back over the mountains after long wandering. One of these was Ottar, the squire of Isildur, who bore the shards of the sword of Elendil. And he brought them to Valendil, the heir of Isildur, who, being but a child, had remained here in Rivendell. But Narsil was broken and its light extinguished, and it has not yet been forged again. Fruitless did I call the victory of the last alliance? Not wholly so, yet it did not achieve its end. Sauron was diminished, but not destroyed. His ring was lost, but not unmade. The Dark Tower was broken, but its foundations were not removed, for they were made with the power of the ring, and while it remains, they will endure. Many elves and many mighty men and many of their friends had perished in the war. Anarion was slain, and Isildur was slain, and Gilgalad and Elendil will no more. Never again shall there be any such league of elves and men, for men multiply, and the firstborn decrease, and the two kindreds were estranged. And ever since that day the race of Numenor has decayed, and the span of their years has lessened. In the north, after the war and the slaughter of the gladdened fields, the men of Westernus were diminished, and their city of Annúminas, besides Lake Evendim, fell into ruin, and the heirs of Valendel removed and dwelt at Fornost on the high north downs, and that now too is desolate. Men call it Dead Man's Dyke, and they fear to tread there. For the folk of Arnor dwindled, and their foes devoured them, and their lordship passed, leaving only green mounds in the grassy hills. In the south the realm of Gondor long endured, and for a while its splendor grew, recalling somewhat of the might of Numenor ere it fell. High towers that people built, and strong places and havens of many ships. And the winged crown of the kings of men was held in awe by folk of many tongues. Their chief city was Osgiliath, citadel of the stars, through the midst of which the river flowed. And Minas Ithil they built, tower of the rising moon, eastward upon a shoulder of the mountain of shadow, and westward at the feet of the white mountains, Minas Anor they made, tower of the setting sun. There in the courts of the king grew a white tree, from the seed of that tree which Isildur brought over the deep waters. And the seed of that tree before came from Eressëa, and before that out of the uttermost west in the day before days when the world was young. But in the wearing of the swift years of Middle-earth, the line of Meneldil, son of Anarion, failed, and the tree withered, and the blood of the Numenoreans became mingled with that of lesser men. Then the watch upon the walls of Mordor slept, and dark things crept back to Gorgoroth. And on a time evil things came forth, and they took Minas Ithil and abode in it, and they made it into a place of dread, and it is called Minas Morgul, the Tower of Sorcery. Then Minas Anor was named anew Minas Tirith, the Tower of Guard, and these two cities were ever at war. But Osgiliath, which lay between, was deserted, and in its ruins shadows walked. So it had been for many lives of men. But the lords of Minas Tirith still fight on, defying our enemies, keeping the passage of the river from Argonath to the sea. And now that part of the tale that I shall tell is drawn to its close. For in the days of Isildur, the ruling ring passed out of all knowledge, and the three were released from its dominion. But now, in this latter day, they are in peril once more to our sorrow. The one has been found. Others shall speak of its finding, for in that I played small part. He ceased, but at once Boromir stood up tall and proud before them. Give me leave, Master Elrond, said he, first to say more of Gondor, for verily from the land of Gondor I am come. And it would be well for all to know what passes there. For few, I deem, know of our deeds, and therefore guess little of our peril, if we should fail at last. Believe not that in the land of Gondor the blood of Numenor is spent, nor all its pride and dignity forgotten. By our valor the wild folk of the East are still restrained, and the terror of Morgul kept at bay, and thus alone are peace and freedom maintained in the lands behind us, bulwark of the West. But if the passages of the river should be won, what then? Yet that hour, maybe, is not now far away. The nameless enemy has risen again. Smoke rises once more from Orid ruin that we call Mount Doom. The power of the Blackland grows, and we are hard beset. When the enemy returned, our folk were driven from Ithilien, our fair domain east of the river, though we kept a foothold there and strength of arms. But this very year, in the days of June, sudden war came upon us out of Mordor, and we were swept away. We were outnumbered, for Mordor has allied itself with the Easterlings and the cruel Haradrim. But it was not by numbers that we were defeated. A power was there that we had not felt before. Some said that it could be seen like a great black horseman, a dark shadow under the moon. Wherever he came, a madness filled our foes, but fear fell on our boldest, so that horse and man gave way and fled. Only a remnant of our eastern force came back, destroying the last bridge that still stood amid the ruins of Osgiliath. I was in the company that held the bridge until it was cast down behind us. Four only were saved by swimming, my brother and myself and two others. But still we fight on, holding all the west shores of Anduin. And those who shelter behind us gave us praise, if ever they hear our name, much praise but little help. Only from Rohan now will any men ride to us when we call. In this evil hour I have come on an errand over many dangerous leagues to Elrond. 110 days I have journeyed all alone. But I do not seek allies in war. The might of Elrond is in wisdom, not in weapons, it is said. I come to ask for counsel and the unraveling of hard words. For on the eve of the sudden assault, a dream came to my brother in a troubled sleep, and afterwards a like dream came off to him again.